Welcome to Battle Ready. I'm Ricky Chavez, and today we're having a powerful conversation about military service, intelligence work, global conflict, and how real-world experiences can shape some of the most gripping stories in modern military fiction. My guest today is James Rozon, an Amazon Top 100 bestseller author. Known for Red Storm series and the World War III military thriller series, James is also an Iraq war veteran who spent 3.5 years in combat zone serving as a military interrogator and a contractor. Over the course of his military and contract career, he worked across the Middle East, Eurasia, and Europe, gaining firsthand experience in counterterrorism, identifying intelligence, biometrics, and national security operations. His background gives his writing a level of realism that readers can feel immediately. This is not an imagination on this page. This is a pure fact. In his experience, his strategy, pressure, intelligence, and the human reality of conflict, it transforms into storytelling. Hey, James, welcome to the battlefield.
Thank you for having me, Ricky. It's good to talk with you guys.
You know, we've had a couple conversations over the last couple hours. I've been kind of listening to some of your other interviews on some of the other shows. Man, what an amazing story you have.
Thank you. Just trying to share what we've learned, you know, passing down the next generation of people.
You know, some of the things that my show's about, you know, I've been on a bunch of different shows, and, you know, mine's about the journey. And one of the things that caught me in one of your interviews is you were homeschooled.
Yep. Yeah. Back in the 1980s and early 90s, before it was cool and everyone knew about it, right? Yeah.
You know, I remember as a recruiter, I came into recruiting in the mid-80s, right? And, you know, homeschooling wasn't seen very often. And, you know, at first there was a challenge getting people in the Army who were homeschooled because it hadn't been validated, I guess.
Correct.
You know, nobody knew, the level of capabilities of homeschooling. You know, everybody's used to the traditional thing. How did that, you know, shape you in your life? You know, you were homeschooled versus this typical kid going to a school. Rick and Morty.
Yeah, the homeschool experience does differ on, you know, each kid as well as the parents who are teaching them. I was very fortunate in that my parents were pretty inquisitive themselves. And so they really taught us quite a bit by having us go and do different field trips and things like that. So when I was younger, you know, my parents had a field trip. They take us, sounds silly, but, you know, we go to a grocery store, see how a grocery store operates and, you know, all the insides and outs. When we moved up to Kenosha, Wisconsin, because I used to live in west suburbs of Chicago, we moved up to over the border to Wisconsin. We lived near a power plant. And so we did a tour. We got to see how a power plant works. And a lot of our homeschooling experience was showing us how different things function and work in real life. And I spent a lot of time around adults, not necessarily around kids as much. Maybe that changed things a bit on growing up and how I perceive things. But in a way, you kind of age and mature a little bit faster in that regards. But I mean, I'm not going to lie and say there weren't some challenges, you know, as well, especially when it comes to functioning in a normal school environment with standardized tests and things of that nature, because that wasn't how we learned or how we were tested ourselves. And so there were some points where I struggled with some of that when I first started college. But then, you know, I went into the military. They kind of reshaped me a little bit more and gave me a lot more of the confidence I needed then to continue on with schooling and do well with that.
You know, I can remember, it was probably 88, 89. The big article around was the first homeschool student who had been accepted to one of the academies. And that was a big deal. And then later on, you know, in the homeschool era, they started having their own like group functions where all the kids that were homeschooled in the area, things like that.
Yeah.
So I know it's grown a lot.
Homeschool co-ops. We had one on Wednesdays as all the families from Kenosha and Racine, Wisconsin. We kind of get together on Wednesdays. Typically all those kids get together and, you know, play different sports together. There was an ice rink we used to meet at a lot. And so we would go there, do ice skating and stuff like that for a couple hours. Sometimes meet at different parks and just a lot of times outdoor stuff whenever we could do things.
You know, that's interesting you say that. My best friend is from Racine.
Oh, really?
My best, yeah, my best friend from, he's from Racine, Wisconsin, and I met him 85 at the Army Recruiting School, and man, we've been thick as thieves ever since. And you know, that's been a long time now, right? He's back there
whole,
now.
That whole area there is a bunch of auto factories. Well, it used to be an auto town, you know, lots of engine factories and stuff. The Chrysler factories, AMC, all the stuff was all there through Kenosha and Racine, that area right along the Great Lakes.
Yeah, and I actually retired out of Great Lakes. I was an Army recruiter back there. I kind of knew that area, and on the weekends, I remember my wife stayed in Texas. They didn't want to go back to the cold anymore, and I used to,
don't blame
you know, drive from Waukegan to Racine so I could get some home-cooked meals. That was a good trip for me. So let's come back. So you're homeschooled, and then you walked into the recruiting office. Tell me about that.
So ironically, so when I started college in the fall of 96, first experience with that was absolutely miserable, okay? I was not used to that kind of a school environment, and I just was not doing very well with it. And at the time, I'd always been interested in the military, and so I was ironically looking at the Marines a lot more. And so I went over to the recruiting station, which at the time was in Racine, Wisconsin. So I drove to the city next door, and I was going to Marines, and I kid you not, they were literally out to lunch. And out walked an Army recruiter. And so he stopped me. I talked with him for a little bit. I did the ASVAB test with him. Then my parents, you know, started learning that I was looking at this seriously. My uncle worked for the Wisconsin Army National Guard. He was an active guard member up at the state capitol. And so he reached out and says, hey, you look at the guard. You can do this. Get your college money paid for. Go to college. Learn some of the jobs, see what's really out there, and then you can go active duty if you want to make that a career. But at least this way you'll get a flavor of it, see what types of jobs are out there, and you can go officer or stay as an enlisted person. And, you know, he knew my battalion commander. My battalion commander became started enlisted, became an officer. And so he was actually his section sergeant when he was an enlisted guy. You know, knew my command sergeant major. The guards like that. It's just very family orientated in a way.
Right, right.
Love each other. And so I went that path. I did that. And I think that was the best thing I ever did. I was gone for 6.5 months for training. Then I was part of a self-propelled artillery unit. Was I 31 uniform signal system support specialist, and then I cross-trained as a forward observer. We were a paladin unit when the Army was transitioning to the paladins at the time. So I did that. That was a great experience, though. I loved being able to do that. Gave me a lot of confidence, good experience, different Army jobs. I worked doing recruiting during the summer months between college, you know, in that inner period.
Sure. Hometown recruiting program.
Doing a lot of that. And as I was actually in Germany when 9/11 happened. I was doing my semester abroad over Munich. And when 9/11 happened, that's when I decided that I wanted to go full time. I was rich school, and I was going to learn, get into like banking or international, you know, finance and looking at that. But then 9/11 happened, and that's when I decided I wanted to go active duty. So at first I was looking at going active Air Force. And as things turned out, the officer side was still downsizing after 2002, I think, the RIF was still going on. And so originally I was selected to go as an officer, but they reduced it down to where they were only going to take pilots and navigators for several years. And so the choice was either I could not get in, or I could go enlisted, or I could go back to my guard unit or go active Army. And at the time, I really wanted to pursue the Air Force. I felt that's where I was being called to. And so I chose to go enlisted, and, you know, that's where life took me.
And then you were spent a couple, like 3.5 years in combat zones as an interrogator. So yeah. I know we're cutting a little close. So give me kind of a quick synopsis of your interrogating experience over there.
You know, so after the Abu Ghraib, you know, incident with the Army, the Air Force got basically the job to handle the interrogation mission. And so the Air Force put out volunteers. They needed several hundred people. difficult to go do this mission for the Army, and so I stepped forward to volunteer for that job. We went for 6.5 months of training before we even talked to a prisoner. And that was a unique experience, man, because you really learn a lot about human behavior, humans, like what the biggest part about being successful at the interrogation mission is you got to understand kind of what makes them tick, what motivates them to want to do some of these actions. It's just like what makes a person motivated to want to join the military, to serve their country, to be involved in this. And if you can figure out how to put yourself into their position a bit, not saying I like them, but you got to be able to figure out how get information of value from them so we can either capture or kill their buddies, because that's our objective. And if we want to end the war and defeat the enemy, you're going to have to figure that out. And that is a tough nut to crack. But if you're able to, then you can accomplish quite a bit.
It stands out with James's stories is coming from homeschooling, giving a shot at college, and then going to the military and becoming an interrogator and being a major part of helping our armed services in the battle. That's pretty amazing. We'll be right back with James. We'll talk a little bit about how he transitioned to being a best-selling author at Amazon. Welcome back to Battle Ready. Stay connected with Battle Ready or every Now Media favorite, live or on demand, every time you like. You can download the Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS and unlock nonstop bilingual programming in English and Spanish. If you're on the move, you can catch the podcast version at www.nowmedia.tv. From world affairs and leadership to business, culture, lifestyle, and beyond. Now Media TV streaming around the clock, ready whenever you are. So now welcome back. We're here with James Rochon, best-selling military thriller author, Iraq war veteran, and former military interrogator and contractor. Hey, James, welcome back.
Thanks.
So you've worked in major U.S. military commands, including J-2 and J-3 commands for U.S. Central Command and U.S. European Command, and the U.S. Special Operations Command in Florida and Germany. We talked earlier about your homeschooling, and in the break, we were talking a little about the family dynamics. Do you homeschool your kids? I know you have little kids.
So at first we were not. We homeschool our oldest daughter. We did because COVID happened. My daughter was going into she was in first grade when COVID started. So it was kind of strange time for everyone.
And I'm sure. Yeah. So
her on a Zoom call for 3 or 4 hours of the day.
The other thing I wanted to talk about is, and we're going to definitely bring this to another show, is that you and your wife write together.
Correct. Yes. Yep. We're a writing, husband and wife writing duo. There's a few of us out there, but yeah.
How is that dynamic?
It's challenging at times. I won't lie. Yeah, it can be challenging at times, but you know, it's also kind of neat to work closely with your spouse on a business like this together, because you're able to divide up some of the work. There's certain aspects of the business I'm very good at, and there's parts of it that I'm not. And my wife happens to be very good at the parts that I'm not very good at. And so it's a very good balance where we divide and conquer that way. And she's able to, you know, for instance, I'll freely admit, I am not the best when it comes to, you know, some of the grammar, spelling, edit specs of writing a manuscript, of writing a book. I've got 2 graduate degrees. I know how to write quite a bit, but when it comes down to some of the nuances or of how to craft a better sentence, a better sounding paragraph, certain things like that, my wife is just far better with those things. And so when we write the book, she has a couple of characters and threads that she'll do throughout the series. And then I'll do probably maybe 75% of the rest of it. But then she takes over the editing with our editor and working that piece and tightening that up. And then I'm already moved on to the next book. And so this way we're able to keep a very steady, methodical process going. And that's what allows us to produce the quantity of books that we do. We've been maintaining a pretty consistent schedule of about, it's usually between, it differs between 4 and 5 per year. 1 year it might be 5, but then the next year it'll be 4, and then it would be 5 the next year, and then it'd be 4 again. So it just depends on the length of the book, as to whether or not it's going to be a 4 book year or a 5 book year.
Okay. So let me ask you this. How did the transition from combat intelligence work to becoming a best-selling author, and how did that happen?
That was pure luck and accident. Okay, so I didn't go to school to become a writer. My backgrounds are completely opposite of this. I originally got into writing as a form of PTSD therapy. When I left the military, left intelligence, all that stuff, that was in 2015, and I struggled really hard with that because I've had jobs where we're hunting guys. Like, we're actually making a difference. We're stopping things from happening abroad. And then you come home and you're not doing any of that anymore. And so, without a mission, without a purpose, I was, spiraling in a really dark, a dark path at that point. And talked to someone about this at the VA. They recommended that I should pursue, well, she said, why don't you write, continue writing? I was like, I can't do the CB, cognitive processing therapy. I can't do that again. That's just too tough. She said, well, why don't you write a book? And I looked at her and said, well, what would I write? And she said, write the kind of story you want to read. No one is writing. And she may not have known my background, but I've got a graduate degree from Oxford. I'm used to writing. I know how to write good stuff. And so I said, that's not a bad idea. There are some story ideas out there. Nobody's writing. So I started doing that. And we put it up for sale on Amazon in 2015. $87 our first month. And I was like, huh, people actually do want to read some of these things. So we wrote another one. And then we wrote another one. And one thing led to another, and they started to take off. And that's when we realized, you know what? I don't need to look for another full job. I can continue writing. I can continue to do this. And so that's just how the book business evolved.
And so I remember, we've had conversations in the past, and especially when we initially met, I remember you telling me that she mentioned doing a journal first, and you weren't really interested in that. And then it came.
It's ironic because my first, when I was in Iraq, I heard training with my other Air Force guys, I'm going to write a book about this. They're like, no, you won't. And what I did is I kept a journal when I was in Iraq because I just needed to have some place to just decompress. And when I came home in end of 2007, because I was there for most of the surge, when I came home, I started turning that journal. And so did get published through a traditional publisher in 2009 at the time, but didn't really go anywhere or do anything with it. The publisher didn't push it out. And then had several years go by. VA recommended, writing therapy, look at getting into writing more. And so that's when I started developing, a series idea, a book idea of how I could pursue writing out a longer story, because really it was my getting me out of my headspace and those darker thoughts and creating a story and getting you engaged and doing something productive and creative, as being stuck thinking about these negative experiences, the things that you guys have done or been involved with in the past. And I was able to take a lot of the stories that I've been around in and just turn them into stories that could be published. One of the experiences that I had is because I worked at a couple of different COCOMs, I really got a good handle of seeing how conflicts happen on like a theater-wide level. So in Europe, scenarios, both with NATO, because we're part of NATO over there, how we would handle a large scale Asian battles against, the Russians, etc. I took a lot of that experience of how we would do that, how we war game, and then just turned them into stories. And lo and behold, a lot of people find that really interesting because it's a challenging craft. It's a challenging type of story to write because there's so many different moving parts. But if you can put it well, it makes for an amazing story. You can't usually tell it in one book like a lot of traditional publishers want it to be done. So we tend to write them in longer series because it gives us time to follow several different units and characters at different operational levels, from your foot soldier who has to actually go out and do the fighting, to your battalion brigade level commanders who have to figure out how do I execute the commander's intent. And then you have the theater and strategic level, the president, the commander, how do we actually implement, you know, national policy? How do we execute that war from a large scale? And so you piece all that together, string it across, you know, 6 to 10 books, you have a really, really neat story that you can follow and just see how some of these things would play out.
But it's not just putting pen to paper, right? There's a whole lot more things that come into play with that, right?
Tremendous amount of research. If you want to do it right, you need to do a lot of research. You know, I don't write where I just be showing U.S. soldiers, U.S. units, U.S. equipment. And then let me tell you, there's a lot of research that goes in with just that because technology changes a lot. There's a lot you need to learn. Because we always fight in a joint environment with allied and partner nations, also need to look into their stuff, how their hierarchy works, how their units and commands work, what type of equipment do they use, because that is uniquely different. So when we're writing about a Swedish unit, or like in the Gotland Deception, we have Swedish units involved, be able to take some time and study how their equipment works, what type of units they have, their structure. I'm fortunate I have a large reader group, and so I'm able to reach out through them to find people I can interview. So I had a former Swedish Special Forces soldier who was really able to give me a lot of information about Gotland, Swedish military, how to get those scenes right. And I do the same thing when I'm writing a tank scene. I've got, you know, tankers in my group, so they'll help me get the dialogue and the mechanics of fighting. And so when you go through and you do that for all these different units, it really brings a lot of realism to it because you have the actual operators who use those systems helping you, the writer, get it right.
So real fast, we got about 30 seconds. Tell somebody, how can they find your books, find you, and get to know you better?
Yeah, so frontlinepublishinginc.com is our main author website. Where you can find it too is on Amazon. Just write in James Rosones, Rosone, and you'll see our author page. You'll see a list of our books, and that's where you can find us.
Right, and you're top 100, right, at Amazon?
We sell a lot of books. Yeah, we're over a couple million books sold worldwide. That's across 11 years, so it's not all at once, but yeah.
When we return, we'll go deeper into the world of military thrillers with James. We'll be right back.
Oh, timer. I had a timer.
You know what? You're lagging. Hey, welcome back to Battle Ready. I'm continuing my conversation with James Rosen, the best-selling author of Red Storm series and the World War III military thriller series. You know, James' books explore high-stakes military conflict, global power competition, battlefield strategy, and a kind of a geopolitical scenarios that, you know, we feel both are dramatic and, you know, uncomfortably possible. You know, we talked a little bit on the previous episode where James was talking about all of the different research he has to do, you know, and all the different people he has in his different groups that can help him best, you know, make it more realistic. James, how did you get involved in meeting all these different people that are out there to help you?
Yeah, so, you know, well, first off, I have a big network in real life from a lot of the jobs and things that I've done. So I started with a big network of people that I would reach out to. I am not afraid of questions. As a trained interrogator, there's no such thing as a stupid question. So I will ask too many questions, and I will work my network. And as my, I started out with a Facebook group, and as my Facebook group started to get bigger, I would ask them, say, hey, do any of you guys know who has worked, who's an Air Force pilot, a bomber pilot? And it took like a few hours. Someone said, yeah, here's a guy. So he linked me up. We started chatting. It was really funny because he's now working as a commercial pilot. He was in Hong Kong, and he was talking to me from his hotel room in Hong Kong, telling me about his time when he was working as a B-2 bomber. And I was writing a scene where I'm actually using a character in a B-2 bomber. So we're going through like what would be the sequence of events to actually, you know, a particular mission that we were writing about in the book. And so he's telling me all this stuff. I'm writing it all down. And then, you know, sending off to my editor to add it into that particular chapter. And then the book's published, you know, a couple weeks later. But that scene and those elements would not have been possible. He hadn't been willing to talk with me. And I caught him at the right time because he just landed in Hong Kong at the time. And he had time to talk to me. So it's just kind of unique how some things work out that way.
That's pretty amazing. And one of the things that, about the show that I really enjoy is, you know, there's a lot of aspiring writers out there, whether they be prior service or just somebody wanting to write. And there are just a lot of different solutions for them to get impact or input or information from people that really know about the specific things. Because as military people, we'll watch a military movie and we just crucify, don't we?
Yeah. It's the same with books. I'm going to make mistakes, but I'll own up to them. And I try to get always saying, hey, look, if I got detail right or wrong, tell me so I can improve on the next one. Because we have a whole team of beta readers. And I tell them, you're seeing an advanced copy. This is 90, 95% done. Usually I wait until it's gone through one round of editing. And then we send it out. I'm like, look, nitpick it. This is when I need to know where the errors and the problems are, not after it's published, okay? Help me refine this thing and make it a tighter book, make it a better story. So at the end of the day, I'm creating these stories for people, you know, for these guys. And if it's not an interesting story, if they don't like it, then people aren't going to want to continue buying it, and I'm going to be out of a business, out of work, and have to go do a 9-to-5. I'd rather not do that. So if I don't seek out that feedback and involve my readers, and that's another thing we do big time with our readers. Most of my characters are named after suggestions from my readers and kind of pay tribute to, you know, friends or family. A lot of times it's usually family members who previously served. Sometimes it's an army buddy that they lost in Afghanistan or Iraq. If it's characters that I pick, a lot of times what I do is I actually, as a little Easter egg, is I pick a lot of former Medal of Honor recipients or people who made significant contributions to the military or some aspect of, you know, supporting the military or major inventions, different things like that. So very seldom character, random character by just chance. It's almost always some historical relevance.
So I'm gonna come with two questions at you pretty quick. So one of the questions is, all right, so now you have all this research you're doing and you're putting your book together and you're getting feedback from the readers and your audience. But I remember in one of our conversations a couple months ago, you told me that anytime, and you know some of the other authors for some of the books that like are actual documentary type books of actual events, but is there something you have to go through with the military? There's I think you told me about a department that has to review anything having to do with military books.
There is a department at the Pentagon that you go through to submit your manuscripts and do, you know, turn them in and things like that. It's kind of It's kind of iffy on how they enforce those things or how they want to do that. Part of it really depends on the subject matter you are going to be touching, your access, and whether you were still in the military. So for me, in my case, I never got into writing and doing any of this stuff while I had an active security clearance or was touched on any kind of military intelligence or classified networks or anything like that. I completely divorced that and I stayed away from my subject matter of what I actually did in the military. So I'm not writing about the intricacies and the nitty-gritty of the identity intelligence program, identity operations that I worked in. And that whole element, I'm wildly away from what I actually used to do in the military. There's still TTL, tag, track, and locates on the kind of the grayish, darkish side of the intel world where you're find, fix, just take out, foreign fighters and terrorists and things like that. I don't write those kinds of books at all. I stay away from that subject matter entirely because I don't want to cross into areas that I used to work in. Some of it's even older than that, but it just depends where you're at. If you're writing sci-fi, you're writing things wildly outside the domain. You can submit things, but at the same time, I've had a lot of friends who've done that, and their books have been hung up for years. And in our business, you can't have a book hung up for years because you have a lot of capital invested in them. And when you're only writing like 4 years, you're publishing 4 books a year. You have 8 books locked up in a series because of the cycles of how long it takes to go through these iterations and things like that. So I avoid that stuff entirely.
My mind is going a million miles an hour because it seems like in today's world, you're writing sci-fi futuristic type books. But I
I'm not
mean,
touching real stuff like that. Yeah.
you say it's not real, okay? And I get that thought, but I'm going to tell you, I was
It becomes
watching.
real in a few years.
It's funny you say that because I was watching America's Got Talent yesterday. And there was this young kid from China that came out and he was a dancer, but he brought out like nine robots. And they, I mean, like realistic, they look like robots, but they were moving and dancing with them and dancing to the music and choreographed. And I'm thinking, man, this is going to be good for me to add to James, man. So I see
I know
this
where
and I'm
you're
like,
going.
wow, how realistic is this? And I started reading the Gotland Deception, right? And they were talking about.
And making it scary because I tell people all the time, you look at Tesla, right, with the Optimus 3 robot that they have there. I am telling you, we are not very far off from where you're going to have a militarized version of that robot. So there was a movie a while ago called Surrogate. Willis, and they had these human surrogate machines. They'd sit and plug into a machine, and you have your human surrogate, and people would live vicariously their lives and stuff through these things. It is the future of warfare, where you have semi-autonomous to autonomous robotic soldiers, you have robotic tanks, you have robotic ships. And that's where warfare is going to go. We see that on battlefields of Ukraine right now. We're seeing elements of that used in the fight against Iran. You're going to see this stuff heavily used in the future because when you look at China's shipbuilding and their productions there, we cannot compete man for man warship against your capacity. What we can do is we can out innovate them by using autonomous surface vessels that we can mass produce, low cost, and we can fill that gap that way. And that is the solution, I think, to handling some of these falls is by using autonomous systems and robotic surface vehicles, underwater vehicles, aircraft, and that's just where it's headed.
Okay, that word autonomous. So I'm doing these surveys for Tesla and about the autonomous vehicles, right? And it's asking questions to kind of train the autonomous vehicles from a perspective of a 63-year-old male, sure, how I would see the same thing to educate them. And so, I mean, I was so unfamiliar with that word. I actually, first time I saw it, I had to look it up, you know? And I think recently, because of everything that's going on, and I've been doing a lot of, you know, looking at your books and everything that's going on, kind of preparing for the show. And then I saw there's asking for stock in a new like drone type vehicle that people will be able to buy in the future. So they'll be able to fly right out of their front yard. What are your thoughts on all that?
Well, I mean, think about it. When my parents are getting up there, and if they want to continue to be able to use a vehicle and go somewhere, these autonomous self-driving vehicles really is going to help give them that mobility, that ability to continue doing that. They're a lot of times safer, and there's a lot of great use that we can do with this. Like any technology, there's always bad, but there's always a lot of upside and good. And that's what we got to focus on.
Well, we'll be back in a minute to talk more about this in the future of where we're going in your book series. We'll be right back with James.
Yeah, the whole future.
Stay connected to Battle Ready and every Now Media TV favorite live and on demand anytime you like. You can download the free Now Media TV app on Roku or iOS, and you can unlock nonstop bilingual programming in English and Spanish. If you're on the move, you can catch the podcast version on www.nowmedia.tv. From world affairs and leadership to business, culture, lifestyle, and beyond, Now Media TV streaming around the clock, ready whenever you are. Now, welcome back to Battle Ready. I'm closing today's conversation with James Rosen. You know, it's been pretty exciting to me because, you know, I've been talking to James for a while now, and I've been actually looking at his books and stuff's been popping up on my computer. So it's been pretty amazing. James, welcome back.
Good to be back.
So the combination of experience, education, and strategy and storytelling gives him a unique voice. So tell me, you put this all together, and we were talking earlier about the movie War Games, right?
Yeah.
Man, that was so long ago, and it was real AI driven, and everybody's like, wow, that's never going to happen. And look where we're at now.
We're there. We're there. It's scary. Yeah. You're almost seeing like the Terminator type stuff with Skynet and, you know, robotic humanoids and things like that coming. It's moving that direction. Yeah.
And so now in your books, you are kind of doing the same thing.
I try to explore those topics. I really want to look at that. And in the military, there's something called red selling, right? And so it's where you have an opposition force and you're going to red sell something to test your vulnerabilities, test your weaknesses. And, you know, again, it's drawing on my own military experiences. So when I work as an interrogator, my objective is to find information of intelligence value. I'm not there to find guilt. I'm there to find actual intelligence or a strategic understanding of what's going on. And all that is to basically capture, kill your enemies, to, you know, defeat the enemy in that conflict. When you look at that, you've got to be able to understand how I would dismantle an adversary. So if I want to come up with a red cell scenario against the U.S., I put my frame of mind, say, okay, if I'm in charge of, say, China, how would I war game and do this and fight against the U.S.? And so I'll develop my outline for my book series like that. And then I say, all right, well, with my U.S. side, how do I counter this? So one of the things I looked at with this particular series, the Monroe Doctrine, I looked at this we started writing this in the summer of 2020. And what I was looking at is Belt and Road Initiative was being used to give them placement and access in a lot of different geographical areas, but specifically in our hemisphere with Venezuela, Cuba, Nicaragua, El Salvador, that whole, you know, in Panama, that whole regional area there. And then, in course, my experiences, I met he's deceased now, but his name was Dr. David Upton. At the time, he was the head of the Oxford Computer Science Program, their AI department, a number of years ago. And so me and him were talking at the time about how they were using identity intelligence and biometrics to track adversaries and people that were coming through Heathrow Airport or coming into London, and how to use that surveillance stuff to identify adversaries. And I was talking to him, well, imagine if you had a super intelligent AI that could take like a brigade or battle group and have it war game hundreds or thousands of scenarios against a similar US battle group or similar size force. It could go through all these scenarios. It could then determine what are the ones that could work, the ones that can. Because where I see it headed is that in the future, you're going to have AI battle managers who are going to be assisting commanders in determining what strategies to employ. How do I best use that technology so I can overwhelm my adversary? And I looked at that and said, you know, that would be a great book series to write and look at. What if the US was facing an adversary like that? And so we explored it in their series. And then how do you counter that? What type of, you know, you've got the drones as one aspect, but how do you protect the soldiers when they're facing this onslaught of drones like you're seeing in Ukraine? It was a very fun series to look at, but it was kind of scary at the same time, because when we wrote this, and we wrote this about how you have these drones being used almost as like precision kill weapons, this was before the Ukraine war started, okay? And then we saw Ukraine, that war happen, and we saw how it evolved. That was a very eye opener, because I didn't really envision seeing my stories coming to life like that. It's really ironic, because the first book series that took off for us was our Red Storm series, and that book, the book one for that series, is Ukraine and Battlefield Korea, Battlefield Taiwan, and we wrote that back in 2017, you know, 5 years before Russia invaded. But having been at U.S. European Command for a number of years, I kind of saw how this was going to play out down the road. It was just a matter of what year it would happen, not if it happened. And so a lot of times it's just looking at the technology and then going forward a few years and just extrapolating where you think it's going to, where you think it's going to be. How is it going to be employed and used? I don't want to be right. We just happen to be right a lot more than we're wrong.
So what do you hope your readers take away from your books beyond the action and suspense?
Every book and series I write is a cautionary tale of whatever piece of technology or scenario we're trying to explore. In the Monroe Doctrine, that one really was looking at AI, and autonomous warfare and how some of those elements work. That was the one, that was the cautionary tale we wanted to look at that with that one. The Red Storm series was really looking more at that symbiotic relationship and tightening of China and Russia, where you're pairing Russia's resources with China's industrial capacity and its manpower, and looking at how that's not a good mix. The current series that we're doing right now with, you know, the World on Fire series, really looking at alliances, why some matter, why you have to have some of these things, and then really looking at the from an internal domestic portion, love of country, patriotism, and service are wildly important. And that you've got to have that if you're going to be able to counter future adversaries. You know, we see all the divisiveness of things happening, but we also just celebrated America's 250th birthday here, 250 years of and excellence. We have to hold on to that and remember what made this country, why our country good, why our country is worth fighting for, why what we do is worth it. So that way we have another 250 years of freedom for our kids, the next generations, and we can continue to be that future.
So what advice would you give to veterans or professionals with, you know, intense real world experience who want to turn their knowledge into writing?
So the most important thing that veterans have got to figure out, and this is goes back to the whole veteran suicide problem we face, you've got to find a way to develop or create a new mission, a new purpose, getting up every day. Without that purpose, that mission, that's when we start to focus too much on what we've done in the past, our should-haves, or what we should have done, what we could have done, how we could have done this differently. When you go down that path, you're going to fall into some bad negative thinking. And it is very hard to get out of that. I know that from personal experience because I struggle with that a lot. I still struggle with some of that stuff. But I've also had, gosh, I think at this point, I've had 11 of my friends commit suicide at this point, you know, since 2005. And so, you know, I've had a lot of my buddies are not here because they couldn't find that new mission in life. They couldn't repurpose themselves. And they just got trapped in the past. And if that happens to you, it's very hard to break out. And that's why, for me, it was writing and storytelling. For someone else, it could be something completely different. But you've got to find what works for you and then put all your energies and efforts into that.
Okay. So we're coming towards the end of our show. James, where will viewers be able to learn more about your books, including the Red Storm series, World War III military thriller series? Where can they find you?
Yeah, our website, frontlinepublishinginc.com, is where you can find us there. You can sign up for a newsletter. And then Amazon, you can find us on our Amazon author page there. James Rizzone, look that up on Amazon, you'll find it there. And you can also reach out. So it's james.rizzone@gmail.com. Try to make it real simple, and you can find us there as well.
Well, James, thanks for joining us and sharing your experience, insight, and perspective. You know, today we talked about military service intelligence work, identity intelligence, biometrics, global conflict, and military thrillers. And to everyone watching, remember this. Some stories are written purely for imagination. Others are shaped by experience, discipline, service, and deep understanding of the world beyond the headlines. I'm Ricky Chavez, and this is Battle Ready. See us again, and James, thanks again for being with us.